Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. We are going to start off by introducing a committee bill. Senator Boquist, I'm going to go into a work session for bill introduction purposes.
Well, yeah, okay.
It is going to be LC 3319.
You can't just make this stuff up, Mr. Warner. We're not an economist. We're not mythical land. Mr. Chair, I move LC 3819 dated 2/20/17 to the committee as a committee bill.
Senator Boquist.
Introduced as a committee bill.
That LC 3319 be introduced. 3318 be introduced as a committee bill.
3819,
Mr. Chair.
Senator Boquist moves that LC 3819 be introduced as a committee bill. Any discussion?
Very quickly, Mr. Chair, just as a reference, that the introduction of a legislative concept as a committee bill doesn't outline the opinion of any member. It simply brings the issue before the committee for discussion.
Thank you.
Give it to me.
Objections? Seeing none, the bill is introduced. I'm going to open up a hearing on our property tax referral jointly, Senate Joint Resolution 3 and simultaneously Senate Bill 151. These are paired together, and I know there has been some grumbling about a tax increase, and that may be what SJR 3 looks like, but it is to be paired with homestead exemption, and when the measures are together, overall, a vast majority of homeowners will receive a tax cut through this measure. At least that's the design. It's a statewide revenue neutral, and there was some wrinkles throughout, which we have to iron out, and that's why Kyle is here. Appreciate the debate over this last week and your help, Kyle, to help us get there. We do have some people signed up. And I don't know if you want to do this first, but there was a very helpful explanatory journalism piece in the Oregonian in the form of a video that I think sets the stage really well for the ongoing discussion that we're having.
It's complicated. It's unpopular. It's Oregon's property tax, and it's evolved over the years, for better or for worse. Until 1990, property taxes were fairly straightforward. You paid property taxes as a percent of the market value of your home. That was it. Done. But eventually, many Oregonians complained of high taxes. So in 1990, Oregon voters passed Measure 5, which for the first time capped property taxes at 1.5% of the property's market value. But the cap didn't help when property values started to climb. Again, Oregonians complained of high taxes. So in 1996, voters approved Measure 47. Legislators said the measure lacked some clarity, so a year later they sent voters an updated version, Measure 50. That passed, and it's where we stand today. Measure 50 completely changed the way property taxes are calculated. Instead of paying taxes on your property's market value, Measure 50 says you pay taxes on the 1995 value of your home, minus 10%, plus a 3% increase every year. That is called a property's maximum assessed value. For newly constructed homes, instead of using a 1995 value, which doesn't exist, the maximum assessed value is set based on other houses in the same county, with the intent to give those homeowners similar savings. Then, like every other home, 3% is added every year after that. Measure 50 was meant to be a better deal than the old system, especially if your property value grows faster than the maximum assessed value over time. But 1995 was sort of an arbitrary base year. It just happened to be the tax year before Measure 47, eventually Measure 50 passed. So homes in areas like Inner Northeast Portland, let's say, that had fairly low property values in 1995 would have a pretty low base rate, meaning lower property taxes. But as neighborhoods have grown more popular over time, house values have climbed. So current residents are paying pretty low taxes on pretty pricey homes. On the flip side, prices on homes in areas like East Portland, Clackamas County, and the West Hills haven't risen as dramatically over the years, meaning less tax savings than those higher growth neighborhoods. What does this all suggest? Well, almost two decades later, Oregon's tax system isn't necessarily fair, at least not the way fairness is defined in most states, where people pay taxes based on what their homes are worth. How do we know this? Well, if you took the total amount Portland area homeowners saved on property taxes under Measure 50 last year and redistributed it according to property values, about 57% would see their tax bills go down, meaning only 43% do better under the current system. And those property tax winners are often in rapidly gentrifying areas. This means people whose home values aren't rising as quickly, which is a majority of homeowners, carry a disproportionate share of the tax burden.
All right. hats off to the Oregonian for that piece. And now, Kyle and Paul, you know what the standard is when you do your visuals.
Have to work on our music, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Egyptians taxed ordinary cooking oil, and you could actually be punished if you didn't use enough of it. Sounds silly, right?
Punished
well, that's
daily,
nothing
Mr.
compared
Chair.
To Russia in the 70s.
All right.
There's always that.
Well, that's his sense of humor. He does this all the time.
So for the record, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for setting me up to follow bells and whistles and noises and everything. I have some a couple PDF files and a few charts to show you. But no, I thought what I would go through is building on the discussion this committee had last week around SJR 3 and SB 151. Was I'd start off with a chart that just hit some of the topics that were discussed, the potential effects, and then goes through some of the policy options to work through some of those effects. And then in addition to that, I have some supporting charts that help to illustrate the topics that I'll be discussing. But so these documents are up in OLIS. I have them all under the SJR 3. Let's see. So the first one is titled The Overview. So if you'll just work through these from left to right, and then I'll bounce around a little bit in some of the supporting exhibits as well. But so the initial topic, or just one of the things that was discussed, of course, is the initial revenue increase. So the SJR, just as a reminder, the general idea was you're eliminating the components of Measure 50 that have the maximum assessed distinction. So this whole 3% growth and tax on assessed value rather than RMB. You'd shift to be taxed on RMB, and then putting in place a homestead exemption for owner-occupied properties. It would keep the permanent rates, but I have some discussion on that on ways you can move around that to get to a revenue-neutral situation. Now, of course, however you want to work through that, that's entirely up to you, but I've, for just the discussion topics, have worked from, well, what would it take to keep it revenue-neutral? And then you can make movements from that base if you'd like. But so the initial change is going to be dependent upon, as the video was discussing there, this difference between real market value and assessed value. So if you shift taxes to be based upon real market value and you keep the same rates, you're going to get an initial revenue increase, a revenue lift. And then you can use that increase to essentially buy back that with the homestead exemption. So you can put a homestead exemption in place, reduce taxes for owner-occupied properties, and you can use that lever to balance it. One thing we'll get through or get to in just a second is also you can, if you make adjustment to the rates, that can also add some revenue neutrality. But so the initial effects, the potential effects there, the RMB to AV, is you'll see certain areas of the state are going to see different revenue lifts. So those areas that have a greater distinction or greater difference between RMB and AV see more of a lift. Ones that are closer, where assessed value is closer to RMB, they're going to see less of the initial revenue lift. So it gives you less room, if you will, to put in place a homestead exemption and maintain neutrality in that area. So that's the starting point. One of the things to keep in mind is putting in place a homestead exemption, we would probably expect there to be, depending upon the size of the homestead exemption, it could put an increased benefit in having owner-occupied property. So we could see a slight uptick in home ownership. And that's that could be a desirable outcome, but it's something to keep in mind where if we assume, let's say, owners are at 60% of people or homes are owned by owner-occupied, if that goes to 62%, you have a shrinking of your tax base. So it's just something to keep in mind, as if you start at point A 5 years from now, you might see an uptick in the owner-occupied property. So that can make a change in future years. And then over time, one thing to also keep in mind, depending on how you set the homestead exemption, the proportional value of the homestead exemption will vary. And that'll depend upon the growth for properties throughout the state. So if you set a homestead exemption at $50,000, index it to CPI, for properties that are growing with their value at the same as CPI, the homestead exemption is going to more or less maintain the same value for that property. But for properties that are growing faster over time, where they might be paying tax, the initial homestead exemption gives them a 20% reduction. Fast forward 10 years, it could be more like a 15% reduction or something lower.
On that point, Kyle, if we pegged it to a median value in at a county, would that take care of that problem?
No, Mr. Chair, but still, you're hitting the middle point. So those that are going faster will just naturally see they're going faster than the median. So faster than the homestead exemption's coming up, they're going to see less and less benefit over time, but they're seeing more growth in the value of their property. And for those that are underneath, it would be the flip side, where if you're growing slower, so the value of your property is going less, over time you're seeing that homestead exemption become more and more valuable to you.
Well, isn't that something of a, I mean, that's not necessarily bad, is it? It's kind of what makes it progressive in some ways?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, exactly. And that's, I definitely don't want to be gauging or putting any, whether these are good or bad, just trying to describe the outcome. But yeah, that could be actually a desirable outcome in a way, because it's aiding some of those properties that are not seeing the same growth.
Thank you.
Okay.
Senator Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, when we last heard this or before, going through some of the side options, I think that the city has brought forward. If you did a switch from to real market value, and instead of doing a homestead exemption, did a one-time levy reset, much as what they proposed, which resets, it takes the taxing district to a levy amount, and then that levy amount then resets the rate. That would be revenue neutral too, and on a district by district, city by city, county by county position, right?
Yes, Senator, exactly. And that actually, I can walk through an example here that'll describe how that does work. It does include the homestead exemption, but that'd be the general idea. Is you could, when you make that switch at that time, you then recompute the rates for the various taxing districts throughout the state, more or less based on a levy amount. So if you say this district levied or they imposed $1 million. Last year or something to that effect, we want to rerun the calculations. We switch to RMV. What would the rate take to still get that $1 million of revenue? And you just recompute the rate. And that, yes, that is one way to really take a snapshot at that time and then make it revenue neutral. And you could do that statewide then, because that was one of the discussions with this committee, is you saw the RMV-AV distinction is different, say, the Portland metro area than it is in Baker County or something to that effect. And that way you avoid being revenue neutral in one area and reducing taxes by 25% in another.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
And that could be done without the homestead exemption, and that can be done on a district by district basis. And so, in short, you're not really increasing the revenue intake at any particular district, city, or entity. It's really revenue neutral at that level in terms of government spending.
Yes, Senator. Without the homestead exemption, the example I have has the homestead exemption, but yeah, you could do it without the homestead exemption. You're just essentially moving to RMV, and then rates would just be going down across the board, more or less. And then so you're revenue neutral for that initial standpoint, and then from there on, you're moving with real market value going forward if you reset and put back in place the permanent rates. So you almost use a levy-based system for 1 year just to set the rates.
Well, Mr. Chair. And how does that, what is the impact on compression and those other factors?
Yes, Senator, that's, you're going to see more pressure on compression in certain areas, certainly. It's going to change for some properties as well. So for properties that are taxed at an assessed value and their real market value is much greater than their assessed value, they're not in compression today, or maybe only slightly. If you move to real market value, they immediately go into compression. That would be something when you're recomputing the rates, you would want to run, when you're running the simulation, more or less run it with compression, because there'd be some properties that would fall into compression, so you would have to maybe move the rate up just a little bit more to make sure the districts are held harmless. But it's we could definitely run something through and kind of show you how the chips fall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Murtigan, could you have a quick question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Back to the homestead, that would apply on just barren land too? It'd be for every lot, correct?
Senator, the way it is described right now, and there certainly could be adjusted in statute because it would be a statutory change. It's the owner-occupied property plus the lot that it's under. So it wouldn't. You would have to have some piece of property have to be on there for it to be a homestead. But you could have a manufactured structure would certainly qualify, or just your standard, stick-built home. One of the areas that you would want to be aware of when designing the homestead exemption is how to handle multiple lot properties or farm and forest property where you have a homestead on the farm property. What would you want to make sure the tax lot underneath it is? Would you include up to an acre, a half acre, something to that effect, so you're not applying that homestead exemption to the 500-acre farm or something to that effect?
That's what I wanted to know. Thank you.
Okay.
If you'll indulge me for a second, I'll work through this example because I think it shows it's not meant to be representative of what would actually happen throughout the state. Rather, I handpicked a few things to try to describe the different ways things could work. But what I have here is essentially it's 10 residential properties, five of which they're in the gray area are considered. These would be homestead properties. And then I put in one commercial property. And this way you could see what would happen here is this is a hybrid of what's been discussed so far is you're moving to RMV, you're allowing the rates to adjust so that the districts are, it's revenue neutral from a district standpoint. So they'd be raising the same amount of revenue post moving to RMV and the homestead exemption. So the homestead exemption I just assumed was 50,000. And I have a series of properties here that are set up with different RMV AV distinctions because that RMV AV distinction that you have today will affect your outcome under a new system. And so if we work through that, you'll see how this comes about. But so just starting here on the left, this residential homestead property, I was saying it has an RMV of 250,000, assessed value of 200,000. So its CPR for this property is 0.8. So it's being taxed at 80% of its real market value. The RMV post the $50,000 homestead exemption would bring it from an RMV of 250,000 to 200,000. So this becomes, in a way, this RMV post exemption is almost a new assessed value in a way. That's what the rates would be applied against. And I have the rates over here, and the key point here is just the overall imposed through this example is $43,420 under existing law. It's $43,420 under the post change. So it is a revenue neutral example. But so for the first property here, you can see the imposed, it was impose about $3,000. Moving over to the next one, it's the same CPR but a different value. And then the following example and so forth. And then you get to ones where, well, this property CPR is 0.7 and this one is 0.5. So the one that's 0.5 is already receiving a greater benefit today under the existing system as it's seen more growth in RMV since Measure 50 went into effect. And probably the key row to be looking at is this, the green one down here. This is the new tax as a percentage of your previous tax. So it's more or less your benefit or your increase. So this first property would be 72%. So that would mean post moving to RMV and the homestead exemption, this first property is now paying taxes equal to 72% of what it is paying under the existing law. So they're seeing about a 28% reduction in tax imposed. And this is largely a function of what your CPR is right now. So the greater benefit you're getting today, the less well you're going to do under the new system. The less well you're doing today, so the higher your CPR is, the greater benefit you will see by moving to real market value and the homestead exemption. So moving over again with the same CPR, about 0.8, you see a 73% tax, 77%, 89%. So as your CPR is going up, going down, you're seeing less benefit by moving to the homestead exemption because you're already receiving, in effect, a greater benefit under today's existing law structure. Now for this fifth property, this one has a CPR of 0.5 today, so pretty low, good benefit under the existing system. It would actually see a tax increase. and that's because the homestead exemption isn't large enough to make up for its existing benefit that it's already seeing from its real market value to its assessed value. So it's just something to keep in mind for those, if you want to characterize them as winners and losers, for those properties that are winning under this current system, depending upon the size of the homestead exemption, they may actually see a net increase in their tax. There's a distinction then when you go to the next property over. This is a residential property as well. It's not a homestead property, but it has a CPR 0.8. Even without receiving a homestead exemption, because it's not doing, it has a higher assessed value to its real market value, this property would see a net decrease in its tax, even without the homestead exemption. So this could be a rental property or some other residential property, I suppose, a second home or something to that effect. It would see a net decrease as well. And that's just because it has a higher CPR today, so it's that RMV-AV difference is less. And then just working through, you can see it really does depend upon where you are today on what your benefit would be. So for the next one, about 120%, one at a residential CPR about 0.7 is more or less equal moving over. And then the commercial property example is something you'd see for most commercial properties, is you're going to see a net increase just due to the fact the homestead exemption wouldn't be helpful to a commercial property. But that's the example of moving to RMV, recomputing the rates to make districts, to hold districts harmless, and then putting in place a homestead exemption. Now, of course, that benefit will depend upon where the homestead exemption is, but the general concept of where your CPR is, the greater, the lower your CPR is, the less benefit you will receive, if you will, from the homestead exemption. And then the table I have right here actually goes to what I was talking about earlier, where you have two properties using them, saying in 2020, they're both worth the same, $315,000, but one's growing at 7.8%, the other one's growing at 3.8%. And these are actually the rates. I stole these from the Tale of Two Houses from Lake of Oregon City's presentation, where it's actually two properties. But if you look through there and you work those rates, and assuming that your homestead exemption is growing at 4%, year over year, so that would be like an average growth for through the county. Jump forward to 2030, and you can see for the first property, the one that's growing the fastest, initially both properties, see their RMV tax is about 84% of what their RMV is. So they're getting that 16% reduction in RMV of what they're going to be taxed at because of the homestead exemption. Jump forward to 2030, the top property, the one that's grown faster, is now taxed at 89% of its real market value, and the bottom one that's growing more in line with the average homestead exemption, the 4% growth, they're still at 84%. So they're more or less held exactly the same, but the property that's growing faster is seeing the value of that homestead exemption decreasing over time, but that's simply just a function of its real market value is growing faster than the homestead exemption. The homestead exemption isn't keeping up, essentially, with its year-over-year change. And that could add, Mr. Chair, as you're saying, some progressivity in terms of home values to the way the system works. Okay, so the next chart I have here was just is meant to illustrate the different median RMVs across the state. So, of course, that's one thing to keep in mind. A homestead exemption in, say, Washington County, which has the highest median RMV for class 101, so these are residential improved properties, is $300,000 in Washington County. So a homestead exemption of $100,000 there looks a lot different than, say, in Wheeler County, where the median RMV is $61,000. So a homestead exemption of $100,000 in Wheeler County is going to eliminate tax for homestead properties of over half, because the median RMV is half the property. So half those properties, more than that at $100,000, would not be subject to taxation. And that's where you would be reducing property tax revenues in, say, Wheeler County quite a bit greater than in a Washington County. The scatter plot I have to the right here, it's labeled percent of district RMV that is classed 101. And that's meant to just give an illustration of different districts may have a greater extent of the property within their district that is classed 101, so residential improved. It's meant to work as a proxy, as an example of some districts are more reliant on residential property than others. The more reliant you are on residential property, the more affected you will be by homestead exemption. Some as little as 0%, so maybe they're it could be a district that's just encompassing industrial land or something to that effect, and then others that are closer to 100%. So if you apply homestead exemption to one that has 90% of its property as residential property, that district would need to, if you're recomputing rates, is going to have to recompute its rate much higher than a different one.
Kyle, so how do we fix that problem that you just identified?
Mr. Chair, that you're not going to be able to fix the difference in the districts. The district boundaries are set and everything, but that would be if you were allowing the rates to reset. That's how you'd hold these districts harmless. It's something conceptually I would have to work through it to see with compression and everything, how would that actually work through? If there's some districts, if they'd even be able to put their rate high enough to hold themselves harmless, it's something I have to think about a little bit more to see how that would work. And a lot of these can be really small districts, road districts, a small water district or something to that effect, and that's where it may not be as big as a deal from a compression standpoint. You're not talking about a county that has to move their value up significantly or their rate up a great deal. So,
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, Kyle, and I think you're using 151's a $10,000 homestead exemption, and you were using like a $100,000 one up there. But the other thing that's compounded not only in compression is that, could you just expand a little bit on the, you said the rate's too low, because many in the seven plus counties in distress and those districts related to that, the problem was is way back when in 1995, they were still getting forest dollars, and so they had intentionally kept their rates, their taxing district rates low because they were being receiving a share of the profits that were coming in from federal forests, both in federal forests itself and in terms of O&C lands. And of course, when it got set and then that money went away, you know, now they're in distress. And of course, those are some of the ones that are pushing up on compression. And of course, if you do a reset at levy, a one-time reset at levy, you haven't fixed that problem at all. You basically have just changed from one institutional sweep of the pen to the next institutional sweep of the pen. And is what you're suggesting, if you went back and looked at the impact of compression and those, then we might be able to address those 6, 8, or 10 problematic areas. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yes, Senator.
It's a little complex, but.
So I have a chart at the end here that describes or at least illustrates what you were talking about there. And this is just the different taxing rates by districts. And the first grouping of box plots here is the larger district. So the rest, the lower one is the special districts. But you can see, I mean, there's certainly a wide variation in cities, but counties is one that probably comes up a little bit more because their cities can definitely have different budgets or different, I guess, areas within their budget, what they're budgeting for, different responsibilities, where a county is more similar. There definitely is different counties throughout the state and what they're responsible for and their needs and everything. But you can see there's a bit of a wide variation between the counties. To your point, Senator, for the lower ones, some of the timber-dependent ones, I mean, compression is definitely, it's a local issue, so it can vary in different areas. Certainly, in a change like this, you'd almost want to think of the education different than the general government side of the Measure 5 coin, if you will. On the education side, because of the backfill from the state school fund, it doesn't matter to a great deal from a permanent rate standpoint what you raise at the local level. If you raise less, say your K-12 permanent rate is lower, you then get more from state funds. So you're going to be held harmless in that way. If there's less money coming in from the property tax system, that's less money for the total education system. But in terms of just a localized issue, if one school district has a lower rate, it won't affect them the same way. They're still going to get their revenue based upon the school funding formula. On the local government side, for the most part, in using these examples of the counties that have the really low rates, you're probably not going to see compression be much of an issue. Because the rates are so low there, they have plenty of room under the limit where you could raise sizable amounts of dollars without hitting where you're really affecting compression to a great deal. I mean, you can get a few scattering of properties here and there possibly, but if you're, I would hazard to say, Curry County, Josephine County, their issue is not compression. Their issue is the low rates, and of course that's whether or not that's up to the local voters and how they want to handle that. But compression isn't going to hold them back from being held harmless under this type of scenario.
Kyle. Senator Burchard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Kyle, if we did a reset button on Measure 50 and say, did the real value reset it at 2010, 2012, just pick a year, and all you're doing is it's everything we got today, we just reset the real value at a different year and then move forward with the same measures 50 stuff in it, wouldn't that correct? Because what happened in Josephine County and Curry County is that at the time of Measure 5 and Measure 50, we were receiving all kinds of timber revenue. So, you know, at one time, Josephine County, we didn't have property tax. So now we were really low in Measure 5 or Measure 50 at about 59 cents. And then Measure 50, Measure 5, and then all the timber revenue left. And we're not, but if we just did a reset on a different year, and we can calculate the different years, wouldn't that correct that in those counties?
Senator, it would depend upon the county situation. It, without having the numbers right in front of me, for the southern counties, for the Curry County, the Josephine County, it would alleviate some of that, but I don't know, switching to RMV is probably not going to backfill to say the level of where the timber was, the dollars from the county property tax revenues plus the timber revenue that was coming in. I'd have to look at it to know for sure, but that's where some of the discussion has been. To get yourself back to a funding level, you might have to do an adjustment to the rates. So if you just simply move to RMV, that might get you a 5% increase or something like that, and don't hold me to that. That's just a number I'm pulling out. But if you get a 5% increase, but from a budgeting standpoint, the county governing body or something is saying we need 15% increase, it'll get you part of the way there, but you would need to reset the rate at that time to get yourself back to the type of revenue you were seeing when the timber payments were at their peak.
Well, I don't think we'll ever get to that. I mean, we built three new high schools in 1 year with timber money, so I don't think we're going to get there. But I think I'd like to look at that a little more. I mean, you know, we could do like do 2005, 2010, and 2015. And I could talk to the assessors in my district to see if they've looked at that. It'd be interesting to explore.
So, Senator Burchard, just to understand, are you talking about doing a switch to real market value and a levy reset with a one-time adjustment? Is that what you're talking, which is three steps?
No, just do a reset on the real market value. So take the RV and move it to an RMV at a certain date, and then just go keep going forward. So the rate would stay the same. It's just the value of the real of the assessed value would move up.
Right.
So it'd be a broader base.
Right. And then you'd see a significant income in lots of areas because your tax rate isn't changing. The idea with a levy reset is you bring it back to wherever the existing levy. So it's revenue neutral at that entity. And then the question is are there taxing districts in which you need to make a correction? And hence the problem. I'll just use your district as a prime example.
Yeah.
That is a challenge, or Douglas County. We'll use Douglas County so we get out of your district. Okay? is Douglas County is a good example. Is if you're sitting in a county in which we have, because they have lost services and they've done some replacement, but the state, for example, as Kyle pointed out, if no matter what they do on property tax related education, the school formula balances it out. So why would they increase their own taxes when we're going to subsidize them in theory? Likewise, we face the same problem in state law enforcement, in which, you know, why would somebody vote for a public safety levy in some of those southern counties when in fact we have moved state troopers down there to backfill those positions and they're getting the state troopers for free? I'm just logic of why would a voter vote for something for a service they're already getting and they don't have to pay for it?
Well, that is some of the politics is you know, my district has voted down to increase funding, so I think bringing the rate up would not be very popular in a district where if you brought the values up, might be perceived as
fairer. Okay. Kyle, you want to go off?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. It's my shirt. Just briefly to this question, referencing a chart this committee saw last week. You can see I don't have Curry County here. They're one of the counties that didn't have data for, but Josephine County, this will actually come down. You can see that on average, accounts are closer to their RMV in Josephine County. So it's something we can definitely work through and model through, Senator, to show it. But it's, you're not getting that same lift in, say, a Multnomah County, where that assessed value is so different than what you see from the real market value. So you will get some of that lift, but it's going to, again, that lift will vary throughout the state. So to a degree of what it will solve or something will depend upon the current makeup of the property and the assessed value RMV. Okay, so this next grouping of charts, really nothing's labeled. The idea with these is really to just impart kind of a conceptual idea of how things would work through. But this is looking at the median RMVs, again, of these residential improved property, these class 101s, in different cities within a county compared to the countywide RMV. And the idea here was just to illustrate, one of the things that was discussed is you could set a countywide RMV, but that could vary then how it's going to affect the properties within a county. So counties can vary quite a bit. And that's the idea of these charts is to show that where each one of these bars represents a different county or a different city, excuse me, within a county. So this is the cities within Baker County. And then the smaller your bar is, the closer you are to the countywide RMV. And it's a percentage difference. So you can see there are different cities that do vary quite a bit. If you're lower, if the bar is going down, that means you're lower, you're below your countywide RMV. If it's above, then you're higher than that countywide. And it's an important thing to keep conceptually wise is, I could use the example of maybe Multnomah County, and you have the Portland area and then the Gresham area. So those are two different cities. And if you set a median RMV for Multnomah County, the value of that median RMV, it's going to be high. It's going to be set at a countywide level, but it's going to affect to a greater degree the value that would become exempt in, say, Gresham, where you haven't seen the growth to the same extent as it would in Portland. And you may see that distinction over time as well. So if you're seeing growth in one part of the county over another, the homestead exemption maintains its value in one part, so it's less tax revenue coming in that part, and say the city of Gresham, where the city of Portland, it would be less effect. It would affect the city less as the properties are going faster there. And there are definitely certain areas where it's closer than there are others where it's more distinct, I guess, where the different growth rates are. So it's just something to keep in mind. There's always going to be variation in how you set the median value, but it's just something to, I suppose, to illustrate. And you can see in a place like Douglas County where you have a couple cities that are above and the vast majority would be below. So again, when you're resetting the rates, that takes care of a lot of that issue initially, and then it would be a growth over time, how that affects things going forward. And that has been one of the things I put in the policy options that was at least discussed, is you could allow a, say, every 10 years or no more than once every 10 years, a district could reset their rates with voter approval. So that'd be something to allow for. Okay, we know inequities are in the system could develop over time. Every 10 years, you allow a district to try to correct those. Of course, it would take their voter approval, but that way you could build that in. So hopefully you don't design a new structure today. 20 years later, you get into a similar mess, not the same mess as Measure 50, but a similar issue where you have different parts of the state that have benefited or different parts of even a county that have benefited and others that are more harmed. Okay, so moving back just to the options, I'll make sure I'll run through the rest of these, I think, pretty quickly, because I got this discussion set on most of them. The timing of moving to AV to RMV, that was just something I would mention, is whether or not this would want to be phased in or if you would just do it the very next year or something to that effect. The upside of doing it, of making the change in 1 year, is you recompute the rates, you get it all done, and you can really see how that revenue neutrality works through. However, for properties, they may see, some might see the properties, their taxes go up, others are going to see it go down in year over year, where if you do it over a number of years, you definitely smooth those changes out for property owners. However, it does get more complicated in how you're going to be able to compute a revenue neutral solution because values are going to be moving. So it's just that it'll be a little bit murky, I guess, to work through it, but just something to keep in mind on how you want to do that. I have a placeholder here on aligning existing statute with the new property base. That's just kind of a bit of a plug that, let's say you work through the SJR, you get that straightened out the way you want to see it and everything, the homestead exemption, your work is not going to be done. Even assuming voter approval and everything to that effect, there's going to be a lot of cleanup that's going to be ongoing in statute. aligning things. I listed two examples are the homestead exemption for and special assessments. So right now there's special assessment for home site properties of farm and forest land. So how you would deal with that, that's something the committee would have to think about. And then urban renewal is one that I know people have asked me about outside of these meetings, how you would deal with urban renewal, because it is set right now based upon assessed value growth and such. So those are things you could clean up on the statute side of things, but it would be all these little things that are going to be coming up as you're making this larger change. And then the last thing was just the administrative costs, of course, we're not the legislative fiscal office, we're the revenue office, but just as a bit of a heads up, there would probably be a discussion on the fiscal side of these things, costs for the county assessors and tracking some of this new stuff and just moving to RMV again. The assessors have testified before of, if you move back to RMV, you're going to see more appeals. That's just, the real market value will matter again to a greater extent than what it does today. So just as a placeholder there as well. I think that walks through most of the major concepts I have here. Again, I would just want to say these don't include all of them. I was just trying to hit some of the high points. We only have so much time, I suppose.
A little disclosure.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kyle, before we're going to have people come and testify, but before you do that, could you pontificate? I won't say opine, that's the legal term, but pontificate on the economics of what happens, let's just say, SDR3. By itself or 151, I don't really care whether it's got a homestead or exemption. It's passed as a 2-year implementation. 3 years from now, it's in. We're now at real market value, and we hit one of those two or three times per century bubbles, and the real market value of these houses all now drops 30%. Walk through the mechanics of how the assessor deals with that and what happens in the taxing districts.
Yes, Senator, that is. So one of the risks of resetting at a particular point in time, so you do a reset based upon 1 year, you reset the rates and everything like that, is what if we're at a peak point in RMB? So I don't know if we're at the peak of a bubble or anything like that, but if we see a decline like you're saying, there's a few things to keep in mind. So the homestead exemption, depending on how you design it, if you design it to move up and move down with real market value, as values are coming down on properties, you'd see that homestead exemption come down. So there would be a bit of a built-in revenue change with that. So properties go down 30%, the homestead exemption goes down 30%. So that on the homestead side of things, that'll keep things similar. Your similar tax, you're not going to see the same distinction we saw in the last downturn where because you have assessed value below real market value started coming down, assessed value was still inching up for a lot of properties. There were some that came down, but you really had this built-in year-over-year growth that you saw. It definitely slowed. But that was one of the benefits, if you will, of taxing below the real market value. Outside of the homestead property, commercial property, industrial property, non-homestead, residential property, you see those values go down, you're going to see actual year-over-year loss in that case because you don't have a homestead exemption coming down with it. So if you recomputed the district rates at a point that was RMV was up here and RMV then shifts lower, yeah, you're going to see less revenue. And that's one of the things I'm moving to a real market value approach is on the flip side, on the when you're going up, you're going to see greater growth than you'd see under an assessed value approach. But I guess it'd be one of those ideas is where as you're going up, districts would want to be mindful of that and whether or not they have different ways to save during the good times for them, those downturns. If it's a downturn that then comes back up 5 years later or something to that effect, that's different than an actual structural shift. If you're saying an actual structural shift down, real market values are just 20% too high, they need to come back down to a historic norm, then you're seeing more of a system issue, if you will, where you're just going to be set at a new, maybe 85% of revenue of where you were when you set it at a higher RMV.
Sure. Senator Boquist. I guess let me ask just a blunt question.
Okay.
Is that if the real market value shifted into taxing district, let's pick a city, you know, or a county, and it's $2 per thousand, you know, against the real market value, and you see a 30% loss in the value, the real market value next year, and then it doesn't recover for 5 years. In reality, is that county going to see a 30% loss of their revenue right off the bat in the first year or two, and then gradually grow back up, or what? I mean, because
yeah, so Senator, So again, the homestead exemption, if it's coming down, it would reduce some of that. So you're not going to see a 30% drop. But depending upon how reliant that city or that county is upon owner-occupied property, you could see 15% drop or a 20% drop or a 10% drop or something to that effect. And then, yes, you slowly try to grow your way back out of it on the flip side. So the homestead exemption helps you a little bit in that way, assuming that it is allowed to come back down. But yes, you would see a scenario similar to what you described, just not quite as quite as extreme on the loss side.
Mr. Chair, in response to Senator Buckley's question, thinking about a sudden drop, one of the other pieces that we actually have built into SGR3 now is direction to look at some type of a moving average over market value. And so you wouldn't, instead of having that point in time that we have now in the current system, January 1st, and then taxes based on that, assessed value of that date, we're thinking about a 3 to 5 year period where market value is averaged over that period, and that would take some of that, smooth that out a bit so that the drop wouldn't be as sudden or the increase wouldn't be as sudden.
Good point. Except
for follow-up in here. So if you used a 3 year average or a 5 year average, what you're really saying is your impact's going to still come in. The question is the city or the county or the taxing district suddenly sees this happen in front of them, and now they have at least 1 or 2 years to plan that, okay, we're going to take a 20% hit over the next 3 years. So they have some lead time, not just magically, okay, pink slips are going out.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Bocas, yeah, I think that's the way it would work. I mean, you're trying to get the trade-off. You're trying to address this issue of inequities that's created by this permanent difference between assessment ratios. So you would eventually correct it so everybody would be at the market value over some period of time. Mm-hmm. But there would be more time for local budget authorities to respond and for homeowners to respond to changing tax bill.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hass. So maybe I missed this in an earlier presentation from the other day, but I assume you have for each county how the real market value is trending for each county. And so some are perhaps not increasing at the rate that they are in other areas. And so how will that work in the long run? In 10, 20 years from now, will there be any negative consequences for some of the counties if what the real market value would be?
Yes, Senator, that is true, and I can just get a chart that would show the different real RMV growth, and even the assessed value growth, so you can see that distinction. But certainly, yeah, in areas where assessed value is closer to real market value, that's because real market value hasn't been growing as fast.
Mm-hmm.
Switching to this system, again, it's how you'd set the homestead exemption that would matter a great deal. I mean, you can't change the if RMV isn't growing quickly in one county, that's just going to be the way the county's growing. But if you set the homestead exemption to grow at that same countywide average or something to that effect, it would stay more or less flat in places that are growing more slowly and then spike if it's in other counties that are growing faster. So when you're resetting to an RMV, for counties or for areas that are closer already assessed value and real market value because of the growth hasn't been as much, you're actually going to see less change.
Less change.
Yeah, they're actually, I mean, yeah.
Thank you.
Kyle, thank you for walking us through this. Obviously, there's a lot of technical components to this, but nothing that I see that is insurmountable, especially when weighed against the tale of two houses that we're trying to fix here, where 57% of homeowners are paying an unfairly higher price than they should be. So we do have a witness list of people that I'd like to get through as quickly as I can, so I would ask a couple of things. First, keep your comments brief. Don't read your testimony into the microphone. We'll have it up here. And second, if you're opposed to this, that is fine. But if you don't like this concept, then I'd be interested in knowing what you would do to address this tale of two houses and to eliminate this unfairness. So let me start off with Alice Bartel, Chris Allman, and Steve Novick. Maybe come up and have your say.
Senator Hodds and members of the committee, I'm Alice Barchelt. I'm representing the League of Women Voters of Oregon, and our testimony is just that we are very happy that you're looking at this, and we expect that at some point we'll be very supportive of what it is that you're trying to do to try to equalize this whole system.
Thank you.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, my name is Chris Allman. I'm neutral because I'm still trying to wrap my brain around this complicated proposal. But I share Senator Boquist's concerns about bubbles. And in fact, my worry is that because of our tax structure, it's actually promulgating more of a bubble economy in certain communities. And indeed, Oregon was listed as one of seven states that I recently found that is got a bubble economy, Bend being one of the communities. And it gets down to where I think in purchasing properties, whether it's residential or commercial, there may be times where the purchase price far exceeds the real market value. In fact, I was found that Goldman Sachs has purchased homes since 2006 in the Portland Metro, and you know, this, there's an area in Beaverton. 29 of 74 homes are owned, and I have to assume that this is spiraling prices out of control. Also in Portland. And then I look at commercial real estate, and I've given in my testimony, I take a hard look at the region's Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon building, and how the price of that, the sale price has skyrocketed, creating not only a huge gulf between the RMV and the assessed value, but a huge gulf between the sales price and the RMV. So one might wonder, given the advantages of not being assessed at these, either the RMV or the sales price, you know, entities with big money, in the case of the most recent purchase of that building, it's WealthCap, it's a German company. You know, we have people who don't, you know, they're not interested in, you know, maintaining reasonable rents because they're going to have to get back their money, their investment, and that's going to pass on to the insurance premium holders. I just want to lastly mention, I was shocked to find that there's correlations between math scores dropping when compression occurs. And to me, all these, this evidence of what we can do, what, how it's harming local governments, how it's harming, you know, schools, how it's harming even potentially, you know, what rate premium holders are paying for their health insurance. We need to do something, and I thank you for what you're talking about and trying to do this in a progressive manner to address, you know, the poorer communities, to address rural Oregon, to address the needs of the whole state. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nover.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, first of all, I want to say how excited I am that you are considering this issue, because the issue of the inequity of our property tax system is one that I think has gotten far too little attention in the past 20 years. And I'm delighted that you're looking at it. I want to talk briefly a bit about the impact of these inequities on the city of Portland, and also to offer you up some suggestions as to smaller changes you might consider if politically it doesn't prove feasible to do the sweeping change you're talking about. In Portland, and I'm sure that the same thing plays out in other cities in the state, we have a phenomenon where virtually every house east of 122nd Street, which is generally the poorest part of Portland, is in compression, meaning that they're all paying the maximum amount they could pay under Measure 5. However, citywide, the city is, quote, losing $100 million a year because of the existence of Measure 50. That means that everybody west of 122nd, well, not everybody, it varies wildly depending on the neighborhood, is getting a combined tax rate of $100 million that the people in the poorest part of the city are not getting. That is extremely offensive. There's a significant number of properties in Portland that are, this is where the assessed value is less than 50% of the real market value, which means that in recently gentrified parts of Inner East Portland, you could have somebody with a $500,000 house that's paying less than somebody in East Portland with a $250,000 house based on real market value. That's appalling. One thing that I found particularly galling when I was on the city council is that bond measures are especially unfair to people in East Portland and similarly situated people around the state. Because at least with levies, the Measure 5 limits protect the people in East Portland from ever-increasing property taxes. Since bonds are exempt from the Measure 5 limits, that means that when the city of Portland sends out a bond, as we did recently for affordable housing and for parks, you've got the people in East Portland having their already high taxes increased at a disproportionate rate. So I'm extremely excited you're taking this issue up. Again, I want to suggest a few smaller fixes. I think it would be great if you did the big fix, and I think you might sort of conclude that it might take a long time to educate folks on this issue. So maybe you send this out in 2018, and then if that doesn't work, 2020, and then 2022 until people understand. I think the media actually has done a pretty decent job of educating people on the inequities. Maybe it takes 4 years to do it completely. But if you don't go for the full meal deal, I would suggest some alternatives. One is you could say simply that for houses with a real market value of more than $500,000, they will pay taxes at the real market value. So people understand that this doesn't apply to everybody, it just applies to people with really expensive houses. Another option would be to say that no house shall be assessed at less than 50% of its real market value. So at least you eliminate the spectacular subsidy to a few houses. And another way of doing it would simply be to say that for future voter-approved bonds, what each house pays is based on its real market value rather than its goofy Measure 50 assessed value. Now, that doesn't mean that anybody's taxes increase today. And by the way, bonds work, of course, is that you're trying to raise a particular amount of money. It only affects the distribution of the bond payments among individual homeowners in the future. So those are the three possible more modest changes. Again, I'd be delighted if you went for the full meal deal, but I just wanted to flag that if that seems politically impossible, there are other, perhaps more easy steps that you could take that would still address inequities.
I really appreciate that feedback, Steve. Thank you very much. As you noted, it's a complicated sell to voters. Matt, you already weighed in on this last week, and I assume you still don't like it. Do you you want to come up again?
I like it even less now.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Matt Evans. I am the lobbyist for the Taxpayer Association of Oregon. It's my pleasure to be here today for commentary on SJR 3. I'll dispense with my prepared remarks, which are already on file, and you can all look at your leisure and your reading time. We're interested, I think, philosophically in a simpler tax system. And we talked about a little bit about complexity about another bill last week. This just adds more complexity to an already complex system. I want to reiterate one of the things I have in my prepared remarks is what Senator Boquist raised, which is this assumption that real market values only increase has been proven wrong not that long ago, frankly. And we have to remember it's not when the real market values of properties go lower, it's not just because properties are less valuable, it's because the people with the money to buy them can't afford to pay more for them. So when you're looking at something like happened in 2008 and 2009, it's not just, oh boy, our properties got less valuable. What happened was people lost their jobs, people lost their salaries, people had reduced salaries, had a more limited ability to pay, and that translates over to property taxes just as it does to try to buy a house. So if your property taxes, you know, one of the amazing things about the Great Recession was the property tax system was relatively stable during that period of time, as was mentioned earlier by Kyle, I believe, where, you know, unless you lost your house back to the bank, your property taxes continued to go up, and you paid them if you were able to pay them. I think you're going to see tremendous negative impacts from moving to a real market value standard. And the other concern I have is just a housing affordability one is, again, increased taxes increase the cost of things. Whatever you're taxing more, you're increasing the cost on.
Nobody's talking about increasing taxes here.
Well, that immediately, right. But over time, I don't think anybody thinks this change in the regime would mean that taxes would grow at a slower rate than they have. Property taxes were $600 million last year. They were up over 50% in 10 years. I mean, are we saying that if we make these changes, the total property tax take is going to grow at a slower rate than that? I don't think so. I think it'll grow faster. So, yeah, it's initially revenue neutral, but over the long term, property taxes will grow faster.
Sure, I do have a question.
Senator Boquist.
Following up on what Senator Haas said at the beginning, and you mentioned trying to make it fairer or simpler, you know, because, good example, I'm one of the individuals in which I pay more than my neighbor does for a like house, and so I'm subsidizing his police and fire and everything else like that. So that's the fair issue. But you mentioned you'd like to see it simpler. Do you have a suggestion or any idea of a simpler system?
It's, you know, I would say, and I don't know, this is, I'm sure staff has done some of this at least, to look at how do other states solve these problems? I mean, you don't hear a lot of talk. I read a lot of publications. I don't see a lot of talk about the same kind of concerns you raise about the fairness of somebody living right next door that has a dramatically higher or dramatically lower property tax bill. I don't see that those sorts of complaints raised in a lot of other states. I'd suggest to reach out a little bit and see if is there some system someplace that's simpler and more equitable,
Senator Reiner,
and doesn't break the bank for taxpayers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we did hear from Kyle about that very thing, and in almost all states, they just do a pure real market value tax system. That's pretty simple. And that's what most states do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think if you could lower, again, it's it's a combination of real market value, dramatic increases in that, or decreases, as we talked about earlier, and the rate that you apply. That's what makes the rate that you apply to your real market value is what you end up with is how much tax you have to pay. And the value of a house has nothing to do with somebody's ability to pay a tax bill. I've seen, I live in a portion of Senator Haas's district where property values have gone. I remember thinking when I first moved over there, somebody put their house up for $250,000. I thought, my God, who would ever buy a house in this neighborhood for $250,000? Well, I mean, that's like a hovel now. I mean, I got a place behind me that went from a $10,000 shack to like $1.5 million with a bulldozer. So, but it has nothing to do, the fact that my property has gone up in real market value in the last 10 years has nothing to do with I'm less able to pay my property tax today than I was 10 years ago. And my property taxes have gone up about 60% during that period of time.
But what we're trying to fix is that the property taxes have gone up disproportionately for a majority of Oregonians who are subsidizing a smaller set of Oregonians.
Yeah,
that's what we're trying to fix.
And they can't afford it. I mean, it's an affordability issue. It's not, I mean,
yeah.
Sure, okay, cut their taxes.
That's what we're trying to do.
If they're subsidized, no, you're not. You're trying to do something that's revenue neutral.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Bob Clark and Doug Schmidt.
Hi there, Senator Haas and other senators, Senator Taylor. I'm a homeowner in Milwaukee, Bob Clark, and I oppose this resolution. I think it's so convoluted, and you're going to have a lot more upset people with this thing than you have with your property tax limits right now. But anyway, you know that. But right now you have predictability in your property tax bill for a homeowner. You know that it's probably going to go up 3% a year because that's the cap on it. But with this proposal, you've got the exemption maybe going at CPI, which can be different rate of increase. Sometimes it's a decrease, and you'll have real market values going up. So it's like you won't be able to predict where your property tax bill is going next year. And without the predictability, it might hurt your own ability to be willing to vote in favor of construction bonds or for schools and libraries and that. And so I think it's a big misstep. So that's where I'm at with this measure. It's pretty convoluted. I've dealt with some people that are older and they've had their house for like 20 or more years and they had the rise and the value, the real market value has gone way up, but their ability to pay for that, they didn't plan ahead for a switch to a real market value that would, former Commissioner Novak's suggestion there about going to really high value. Some of these seniors do live in those older houses that are really appreciated, and so you're going to have some real losers here, and much more than I don't have the foggiest what my neighbor's paying in property taxes, and I think that's the case with most people. I ran for City Hall in Milwaukee this last fall, and going door to door, most of my neighbors, they were very fearful of their property taxes going up. They weren't bent out of shape about what their neighbors paying. They didn't even have the foggiest either what their neighbors paying. So this is maybe a special problem in Portland, in the city of Portland itself.
The problem happens all over the state.
Yeah, but I don't think I think you're creating a lot more unhappier people going to this solution than sticking with the limits that we know. When you buy a house, you see the last property tax bill, and so you can get some prediction about where it's going. But this thing is like, whoa.
Okay, thank you.
Anyway, bye. Thank you.
Chair House, members of the committee, Douglas Schmidt, Polk County Assessor. I'm testifying today just as the Polk County Assessor. Couple things. Kyle covered a lot of information, and he raised a couple concerns that I had too. One was the definition of the homestead. What is that? Just the house and basically an acre. So I'm assuming that would be cleaned up in statute or something. And then assessors don't really have a mechanism for truly identifying what properties are owner occupied. That would be an issue of how we go about doing that. And then just as information, in Polk County, the overall real market value between the peak in 2008 and now dropped 18%. And that's the real market value, while the assessed value actually went up because there was that buffer there. We are just now at the market value that we were in 2008. And when you look at a rolling average, a 5-year, 3-year, the drop is almost the same. It just goes, the drop is later and comes out later. So it does, that decrease is there. So the one thing that, if possible, more from a district point of view and my budget point of view as the assessor, is, and I don't know if this can be done, is some type of a buffer for districts that we have currently with the assessed value, market value. Unlike the state, who deals with true whatever income tax comes in, and if you get less, then there's cuts. In this recession, we still had to do cuts, but they weren't as dramatic. And I don't know if there's any way. The rolling real market value might be a mechanism, but it still would not create that much of a buffer. So those are my comments. Kyle covered a lot of the issues that we had. If you have any questions, I'll try and answer them.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to go back to clarify for the record, Doug, and as you said, it was roughly 18%.
Yes.
And even if you had a rolling value, it was still 18%.
It was close. It was just a little bit less, but it was close to it. Senator Hass, Senator Boquist. Yes, that is true.
So then in practicality, on nuts and bolts on the ground, market crashes in 2008 as it did, had we been in a system like this, would it have been the following year when you would have said, okay, we're only going to, the real market value is now 18% less, and so the bill's going out, and really, as a tax collector, you're only going to get 82% of what you got last year? How did, in practicality on the ground, how does that work?
Without taking into account homestead exemption and all of that, that would have been correct. Okay. If the permanent rate, if the market value is applied to the permanent rate, that would have been an 18% decrease. That's correct. Okay. Just straight market value to rate.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you both. Jody Weiser, John Chandler, and Gil Riddell. Again, if you could keep your comments brief, we do have a couple issues to deal with before 10 o'clock here in this committee.
Chair Hass, members of the committee, I'm Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. We're really excited that you're looking at this issue because while Oregon's taxes as a whole, state and local taxes, is one of the fairest tax systems in the country in terms of distribution across income levels, our property taxes are a mess because of the inequities between properties, but also because without a sales tax, we need to have our income tax and our property tax produce more revenue than the average state, and we're pretty average on property taxes. And the effects of Measures 5 and 50 have been much more beneficial for commercial property owners than for homeowners. And so the balance of who pays how much in property taxes has changed quite a lot. We think that some of the policy choices you're looking at are right on, although I think I just learned that phasing it, having a spread of years might not be as effective as we were hoping they would be. But phasing into real market value makes sense. Using some kind of multi-year average, maybe, but some buffer. I don't know how we do that. That has to be looked at. We should end the 3% timely discount. We share that. That's kind of like our kicker. Florida is the only state we could find, and the city of New York, that has a discount for timely payment of taxes. And we need to set some kinds of floors, not just caps, for K-12 funding and for public safety, because otherwise people in other parts of the state pick up the costs that a local community refuses to serve. We would add one more change, and that would be that you would not have a deduction from school funding if you were in an enterprise zone or a strategic enterprise district. Those are all changes that have been added to our tax code since Measures 5 and 50, and they are dramatically giving benefits to businesses, but they are dramatically impacting funding for K-12 as well. So we propose that as you look at a change, you think of the issue both politically and strategically and consider this option. What if we raise or change the tax structure, not raise, but change the tax structure for business properties only, not for residential properties in the first step? Because the business property owners aren't going to have as many votes as people would to begin with, so you might get this change made. People understand that businesses aren't paying a fair share. And as the graphs I've given you show, the businesses have really gotten a benefit, and those graphs would be pretty effective with the public, I think, in showing that residents are picking up more than their share of taxes. And we have a Mrs. English that's pretty perfect. Anybody that's been to Portland has seen Big Pink, the U.S. Bank Corp Tower. It sold in 2015 for $372 million. Its assessed value is $60 million. So its tax, you know, his taxes would go up six times to get to real market value. Obviously, there would be a rate change, but I don't think there's any homes with that big a tax break because the measure's 5 and 50. And it's something that, you know, it's we need a Mrs. English to get people to understand the problem. I haven't looked at a lot of other buildings' taxes. I did have in my file something about Comcast's taxes, and their property tax break is only about 50%. Well, that's a big difference, paying one-sixth what you would pay at real market value and paying 50% of what you would pay at real market value. So those two businesses with dramatically different impacts because of our tax system. I just think that looking at this as a two-step process and proving that we can make a graceful change to a values, a tax system that looks at real market value would be a politically adept thing for us to do. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. I was sitting here trying to remember the last time that Ms. Weiser and I appeared on the same side of an issue. And as to this measure, it may be a first. Not the rationale, mind you, but the starting point.
I see a trend.
That's how rumors start, Mr. Chair. This is an issue that the home builders have weighed in on, I believe, ever since Measure 50 passed, because we thought that was, well, we thought 47 was dreadful, 50 was a slightly less dreadful fix to the dreadful measure. We thought it was bad policy from the outset. We also thought Measure 5 was bad policy, and if I had my druthers, we would take both of them and toss them out, constitutionally speaking. Realizing the political reality and the difficulty of that, I think that the fundamental point we're bringing to this is if a local community wants to pay for things locally, they ought to be allowed to do so, and there's absolutely no reason for the legislature to step in the middle of that. That said, one of the problems we're facing in this state, as you all know, you've heard this many times before, is housing prices going up. One of the significant drivers of housing prices are SDCs, system development charges, and government fees, costs, permits, et cetera. And one of the main drivers for SDCs and government fees and costs is the fact that local governments simply don't have any other sources of revenue. I don't believe there's a city in the state that has imposed an SDC just to be mean to new home construction or new construction generally. They're doing it because they need the infrastructure, roads, water, sewer, et cetera. And I was, when we passed the SDC law in 1989, none of us thought about $30,000, $50,000 SDCs. And it's fascinating to me. In fact, as a little bit of a plug, you'll see a bill later this session. I hope to do a revisit of SDCs generally, because one of the main theoretical underpinnings for our SDC law was taken out when the voters passed Measure 5 in 1990, a year after the SDC policy was adopted. We need to have the flexibility at the local level to allow local governments to pay for those kinds of necessary infrastructure pieces on a broader basis. That's how we used to do it pre-Measure 5 and 50. There's a role for SDCs going forward, certainly, for new development to pick up a part of the tab. We're not quarreling, but at $50,000 a house, you cannot do affordable housing. And not only can you not do affordable housing, but even the housing that was previously somewhat affordable goes up, because that's how markets work as you add those prices. This is an issue long overdue for a correction. I really commend the committee. I know it's been in front of the legislature before. I'm sensing this time we may be serious about it. I hope you are. We stand ready to help as this measure goes forward, or as companion pieces, to do some wordsmithing and crafting. This is critical, I believe. In fact, I would submit it's more critical to fix local property taxes and the irregularities and equities there than it is to fix state tax structure. If you had to pick between two paths to spend your political capital on, I would strongly encourage you to focus on what's happening at the local level. My personal belief is that every city in the state is going broke because of Measure 50 and Measure 5. Some cities are able to cover it up with cash flow more adequately than others, but at 3% increases on an artificial value based on the square root of 19 is multiplied by something in 1995, they can't keep up. And it's silly to think they can. This is a great effort. Please continue. Let me know how I can help. I'll be glad to take questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gil Riddell, Policy Director, Association of Warren Counties. I apologize for my raspiness. I seem to have developed a facility this session of picking up every virus that wanders through the Crazy Capitol. I will try to speak as fast as John, although that's difficult. I did provide this with the highlighted. I hope you have it in front of you. On March 13th, the governing body of AOC will be back in Salem, and I'll present all these issues that you're wrestling with to them and share their thoughts with you. excuse me. I wanted to make a couple points from county perspective, though, in the meantime. I know you're not undergoing an academic exercise. This is balancing policy with political realities. But if you look at the four fundamentals of revenue and taxation, the current property tax system fails in three. Adequacy, it does not accommodate the inevitable future changes in economic circumstances. The southwestern Oregon is the exact example of that, a dramatic change out of control of the counties, and then permanent rates put in place. There's no accommodation for that. So how could it be adequate? And disconnection from real market value keeps those counties behind. Equity, well, we've talked about that. And it's a little embarrassing that this system benefits the gentrified neighborhoods and sticks it to the poorer neighborhoods. Minimizing market distortions, the property tax has been used for that, frankly, for incentives, which does that since before Measure 5 and 50. But when we had a levy-based system, the services could still be provided, notwithstanding the shift in tax burden. Under our rate-based system, the trade-off is the incentive versus the loss of revenue, which may be permanent or maybe brief, but could also be permanent if the incentive proves not to work. And then finally, administrative efficiency. I think that's the only one this measures that we're able to help on that, irrespective of the complexity. We're very proud of the core in the state of county assessors and tax collectors. I understand the political delicacy of reforming permanent property tax rates, but imagine you were just introduced to this system and you took a look at this column. It is senseless. Why should Josephine County pay 59 cents a thousand on assessed value while Sherman County is paying $8.71? It is difficult to understand. And it has real consequences, as we know, having been documented in Josephine County in public safety area. The idea of a companion statutory homestead exemption is very helpful. And if it's constructed so that it's flexible by county and takes into account circumstances on property values and permanent property tax rates over time. Counties need this reform. This is their far and away their major tax. 80% of the taxes that they use to provide essential public services are from the property tax. And we'd like some rationality back into the system. It's a foundational system for public services. So thank you, and thank you, Senator Riley, for the lozenge. You did help.
Good. Thank you, three. I think you all represent a different spectrum, and the fact that you're encouraging the committee to move forward is good. Senator Bertschiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gil, you asked a question about 59 cents for Josephine County, and I'd say that is low, but I'm going to, you know, I'm getting a lot of criticism in the building right now, especially this session, that my district is drawing resources from the state. And a lot of those same critics that are critical of that are the same people that encourage the destruction of the utilization of natural resources. Isn't that amazing? Now, my district is 63% federal land, and when you throw in the forest commercial lands, it pushes it up to 80% of the acres in my district do not pay any taxes. So when you make that statement, you need to add in some of this other stuff, okay? Because before the destruction of the utilization of natural resources, both forestry and mining, and now agriculture, we didn't pay any taxes. We had the best sheriff's department. We built three brand new high schools in 1 year, a brand new fairgrounds. We had the best roads. And in 30 years, it is flipped. So you need to interject that into the conversation, well, too.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bertschiger, I don't disagree with anything you said. I've been here since 1987. Been through all that. I could recite it back to you. I completely understand. The problem is with the current system is the locking up of local flexibility.
absolutely.
It makes your local citizens unable to adjust to what is inevitable. There's going to be changes in the economic situation, the cultural situation, and you've got to be able to respond to that.
Well, my point is the people that are critical of what's going on today were actually some of the same people that caused the problem.
On that note, we're going to leave it. Thank you. Thank you, all three. We've run out of time here. I'm going to have to carry over Senate Bill 174 and Senate Bill 145. Tomorrow at 8:30, the revenue forecast right here. House members may or may not join us. They're certainly invited. And so until then, we will adjourn. Until then.